Antony Blinken and other top officials from the U.S. are in the Middle East on a massive diplomatic push.
What we want to see in terms of governance in Syria is governance that is seen as credible and legitimate.
Fighting in Syria has finished, but the anger remains.
Everyone we speak to here says they lost someone to the brutal prison system that collapsed with the regime.
And what exactly is birthright citizenship?
Everyone, at least at birth, is considered equal in terms of the obvious civic rights.
Today is Friday, December 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Top Biden aides are in the Middle East this week to push for a ceasefire in Gaza and avoid fallout in Syria following the ouster of President Bashar al-Assad as neighboring countries, including the U.S. allies Israel and Turkey, make their moves. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is meeting with leaders in Jordan and Turkey, while National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan is making the rounds in Israel, Qatar, and Egypt. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara gets us started.
A new Syria recognized and supported by the United States. That is the incentive the Biden administration is using as leverage at a moment of deep uncertainty following the fall of President Bashar al-Assad. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby to VOA.
What we want to see in terms of governance in Syria is governance that is seen as credible and legitimate, that is sustainable, that meets the aspirations of the Syrian people, and that is the result, the product of a Syrian-led process to get them to that point.
Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, the rebel group that toppled Assad, is a U.S.-designated foreign terrorist group. There is a $10 million bounty on its leader, Abu Muhammad al-Julani.
This victory, my brothers, is a new chapter in the history of the entire Islamic nation. It is a turning point for the region.
In recent years, Jilani has distanced himself from extremist ideology, but he gave his victory speech Sunday from an ancient Sunni mosque in Damascus, not the presidential palace, a worrying sign for some. Michael Rubin, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, via Skype.
On the rebels' own Telegram channel, there were statements saying, we've taken the Umayyad mosque, next we're going to go for Al-Aqsa, which is in Jerusalem, of course, then we're going to go for the Kaaba, which is in Saudi Arabia.
U.S. President Joe Biden moved quickly, launching airstrikes on Islamic State targets in Syria on Sunday, and on Wednesday, sending his top diplomat to Turkey and Jordan to consult with leaders. But on January 20, Biden will be replaced by Donald Trump, who is signaling a hands-off approach. On social media, Trump warned, "Let it play out, do not get involved." But the U.S. is already involved. It has about 900 troops deployed in Syria and backs a Syrian Kurdish rebel group. Washington also has close ties with all of Syria's neighbors, Iraq, Lebanon, and U.S. allies Israel, Jordan, and Turkey, said former U.S. ambassador to Syria, Ryan Crocker.
Don't disengage completely, certainly not. But if you don't want to be overly engaged yourself as the United States of America, this is the time to work very closely with partners around the region.
It's not clear whether under Trump's America First doctrine, the U.S. would aim for what Biden wants, a future Syrian government that's inclusive and non-sectarian. Meanwhile, other stakeholders have started their next moves. Assad was backed by Moscow, which is already lobbying to keep Russian military bases in Syria. In the north, Syrian Kurds are displaced as rebels supported by Turkey attacked U.S.-backed Kurdish fighters, whom Ankara sees as allies of a separatist movement. For now, Iran has lost much of its leverage, especially with Israel launching strikes across Syria, further weakening the remaining military capability of Tehran's one stalwart ally. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News, Washington.
As we've heard, Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in the Middle East today for talks with Jordanian and Turkish officials about the fall of the Syrian regime. Israeli troops have taken over a buffer zone between the two countries, and Israeli airstrikes have decimated much of Syria's weapon stores. VOA's Linda Grantstein has the story from Jerusalem.
After a meeting with U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan in Jerusalem, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said that Israeli troops will remain in a Syrian buffer zone next to the Golan Heights until some force on the Syrian side can ensure security for Israelis. The UN, as well as France and other countries, have accused Israel of violating the 1974 disengagement agreement, but Israeli officials say the move is temporary. Israel fears that after the ouster of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, a vacuum was created as troops that had been in the buffer zone fled. Israeli troops moved in to take over the area, and the prime minister's office said that Israel will not permit militant groups to fill that vacuum and threaten Israeli communities on the Golan Heights with October 7th-style attacks. The statement referred to the October 7, 2023 attack by Hamas from Gaza that killed some 1,200 Israelis and led to 250 being taken captive, 100 of whom, both living and dead, are still being held today. Brigadier General Reserve Nitzan Nouriel, the former head of the Counterterrorism Bureau in the Prime Minister's office, says Israel is watching events in Syria carefully.
That the worst-case scenario in Syria is that Syria may become Somalia of the Middle East, meaning many organizations fighting each other, and stability will not be the nickname of Syria for the next few years.
Over the past few days, Israel has launched hundreds of airstrikes on weapon stores and seized tanks and other weaponry. Israeli military analysts like Nouriel say they believe Israel has destroyed almost all of Syria's offensive capability.
This is a pure preemptive attack to make sure that those unexpected rivals will not be able to use aircraft, artillery, chemical weapons, and so far and so on.
Israel is carefully watching rebel groups that are taking control in Syria. Former senior intelligence official Avi Melamed says that Abu Mohammed al-Julani is the head of the HTS group, which seems to be taking power in Damascus.
In its early days, Abu Mohammed al-Julani is part of this Jabhat al-Nusra, is the leader of this group, even though not the sole one yet. And this is a group that is connected to al-Qaeda. He's coming from the Abu al-Qaeda. He was operating in Iraq and in Syria.
But Melamed says that in recent years, Julani has broken away from al-Qaeda and seems to have moderated his positions. Meanwhile, Israel on Thursday withdrew from the Al-Khiyam village in South Lebanon, and Lebanese army troops took over as a two-week-old ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon seems to be holding. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Meanwhile, despite diplomatic efforts, anger in the Syrian capital is palpable as families search for loved ones who have gone missing or died in the fallen government's brutal prison system. At a rally in Damascus, VOA's Heather Murdoch reports crowds are calling for the execution of ousted President Assad.
Rage in Damascus is deep and widespread. At this funeral for a prominent victim of prison torture, people call for the execution of President Bashar al-Assad, less than a week after he fled the country. Everyone we speak to here says they lost someone to the brutal prison system that collapsed with the regime. We found this woman weeping on the sidewalk.
My God, where is my son? I want to see him, hold him, and smell him. I don't know where he is. They took him from me. I hope God takes them.
The young man being buried, Mazen El-Hameda, died in prison after speaking publicly about being tortured. At this hospital, families are searching for the bodies of people they believe to have died recently. Pictures of the bodies hang on the walls outside. Many, we are told, have wounds that appear to be from torture. Inside the hospital, dozens of bodies await identification. But most families who have come here don't find their relatives. This is Majda Abu Al-Omani, a mother of two missing young men.
My sons were arrested in 2014. They gave us death certificates, but we didn't know what happened to them. The scene in here is indescribable. It makes your hair gray.
At the notorious Sednaya prison, other families search for clues that may help them find their missing loved ones. Many believe there are missing prisoners who are still alive in long-hidden secret facilities. At the prison, Khamis El-Ibrahim is searching for his brother.
There are living souls under this ground, not just one or two. It's been 4 or 5 days we've been here at Sednaya, and so far, nothing.
People tell us that their relatives were arrested for unknown reasons, or for saying something negative about the government, or even for living in an area populated by activists or rebels.
Since we have been here, many people have come up to us to express their anger and their sadness, with one man saying, "People all over the world have known about this for decades, and why are we just coming to film now?" Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Damascus.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump said Wednesday he chose Carrie Lake, a politician and former journalist, to be the head of the Voice of America, a government-funded international broadcaster. Lake is a close political ally of the president-elect and a former news anchor for a television station in Phoenix, Arizona. She worked in journalism for 27 years before leaving the profession in 2021 to run for Arizona governor. Zimbabwe's Senate has approved a bill to abolish the death penalty, and it's now set to be signed into law by the president. Zimbabwe, which uses hanging for capital punishment, last executed someone in 2005. President Emmerson Mnangagwa is expected to sign it into law, making Zimbabwe among four countries that have recently taken steps toward abolishing the death penalty, according to Amnesty International. The others are Kenya, Ghana, and Liberia. Meanwhile, China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Somalia, and the U.S., in that order, recorded the most executions last year.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strobe. Time now for our look at U.S. politics. How U.S. foreign assistance is allocated and where it goes are two key questions as the Trump administration prepares to take office in January. VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias looks at some sectors where cuts are expected and others that may be a priority.
Medical supplies for India, food aid for Gaza. The United States donates more foreign aid than any other country in the world. Just in fiscal year 2022, it obligated some $70 billion, that's 1% of the total federal budget, for humanitarian assistance, economic development, peace and security, and other sectors abroad. It's not clear what President-elect Donald Trump's approach to foreign aid will be when he begins a second term in January. But during his first term, Trump made his views known at the 2018 United Nations General Assembly.
We will examine what is working, what is not working, and whether the countries who receive our dollars and our protection also have our interests at heart. Moving forward, we are only going to give foreign aid to those who respect us and, frankly, are our friends.
As president, Trump did cut some foreign assistance, but Congress often pushed back on his suggestions to do so. Associate Professor of Policy and Government at George Mason University, Jeremy Mayer, via Skype.
He made some significant reductions in any amount of money going towards climate change. He made some other changes like the Palestinian aid, but a lot of the normal aid policy of the United States continued relatively unchanged.
Trump restricted U.S. support for abortion education and services in his first term, as previous Republican administrations have, and he is expected to do so again, says Bonnie Glick, a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. She served as deputy administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development under Trump. She spoke via Skype.
Under the Biden administration, there have been ways that abortion providers have received funding for things like abortion education. Under the first Trump administration, we did not allow funding to go to NGOs that were promoting abortions.
Trump's pick for Secretary of State Marco Rubio told Congress in February that, quote, "what happens around the world does matter and that the U.S. should care." But in his view, Trump's America First policy takes precedence.
On issue after issue, we either have lost all common sense or we are consistently ignoring the needs of everyday hardworking Americans and putting something or someone above them.
Blick says the new Trump administration will look carefully at where U.S. tax dollars are being spent. She shared her views via Skype.
I suspect that there will be an audit of all of USAID's global programs in 100 different countries around the world.
The aim, she added, will be for the U.S. to get the most from countries receiving taxpayer dollars. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Russian President Vladimir Putin is backing a Hungarian plan for a Christmas ceasefire in Ukraine, even though Kyiv has scoffed at the idea. Reuters' Zachary Goldman has this report.
The Kremlin on Thursday said Russian President Vladimir Putin supported a Christmas ceasefire in Ukraine proposed by Hungary's president. Viktor Orban, who is among the most pro-Russian politicians in the European Union, suggested a pause in fighting and exchange of prisoners between Kyiv and Moscow. Orban and Putin spoke on Wednesday. Shortly after the Orban-Putin call, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky criticized the Hungarian leader for undermining Western unity.
Slava Ukraini!
Zelensky has previously outlined what he called a victory plan, which included commitments of Western military aid and NATO membership to ensure Russia did not use any ceasefire to prepare another military assault. Russia has said it would never accept Ukraine joining NATO or the deployment of NATO troops on Ukrainian territory. On Wednesday, a Russian foreign ministry spokesperson said, quote, "If anyone expects Russia to make any concessions, then apparently these people do not have enough knowledge and perhaps a short memory." Next month, U.S. President-elect Donald Trump will take office. He has vowed to swiftly end the conflict, but has given no details on how he might achieve that.
Zachary Goldman of Reuters reporting for us today.
In a related story, French President Emmanuel Macron was in Poland meeting with Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk and President Andrzej Duda to discuss support for Ukraine and the possibility of European troops enforcing a peace deal if one can be reached. Anna Chernikova has more from Kyiv.
French President Emmanuel Macron and Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk met on Thursday in Warsaw to discuss increasing support for Ukraine and the possible deployment of European troops to Ukraine for a peacekeeping mission after a peace agreement is signed in the war between Russia and Ukraine. A number of European media outlets reported that President Macron and President Duda are planning to discuss the deployment of peacekeeping forces in Ukraine after the war. No details are available at this time. During the joint press conference, Tusk noted that Poland is not planning such actions yet. Poland will work with France and other European countries on solutions that will protect Europe as well as Ukraine.
Seule une paix durable.
For his part, Macron said that Europe must work closely with the United States and Ukraine to find a solution that takes into account Ukraine's interests and sovereignty, as well as the interest of Europeans and the security of the whole of Europe. This is the philosophy that we are going to focus on, the French president said. Meanwhile, Donald Trump said he is against Ukrainian strikes deep into Russia with American missiles and criticized Kyiv for launching ATACMS missiles deep into Russian territory. At the same time, he promised that he would not abandon support for Ukraine in his attempts to help end the war. Trump said that he would use U.S. support for Ukraine as a lever to pressure Russia in negotiations. He said he wants to make a deal and that the only way to make a deal is not to abandon Ukraine. Also says the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was in Zaporizhia, which is currently one of the hottest areas of the front line. Zelensky met with brigades defending Zaporizhia and Donetsk region and discussed improving training. Zelensky visited the first underground surgical department in Ukraine. This hospital is saving the lives of Ukrainian soldiers who arrived directly from the battlefield. Zelensky also visited the site of the hospital in Zaporizhia, which was hit by a Russian ballistic missile on December 10th. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
On the campaign trail, Donald Trump said he would eliminate birthright citizenship, which is the notion that anyone born in the United States is a citizen of the U.S. regardless of the status of the parents. I speak with Muzaffer Çişti, a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute, about what ending birthright citizenship would mean.
So in 1868, Congress enacted the 14th Amendment, and it says clearly in its language that every person, emphasizing person, born in the United States is a citizen at birth, except those who are not subject to the jurisdiction thereof. So that's where the controversy comes. is that, does that include literally every person born in the United States, or are there some restrictions? The Constitution, the 14th Amendment, says subject to the jurisdiction thereof. That was taken to a Supreme Court in 1898, and the decision of the Supreme Court said, yes, children born to a Chinese person who was not a citizen are granted 14th Amendment protections. So that's the background. So since then, the interpretation of this, because of the Supreme Court ruling in 18, is that everyone is born in the United States, and people who are exempted from it is just one category now, which is children born to diplomats serving in the United States, because they're not subject to the jurisdiction. So this is the only exception. So every now and then people say, well, just people who come for only a few days and go to a maternity ward and give a birth, should that person be entitled under the strict reading of the Constitution?
Is that one of the big drivers of migration? Are lots and lots of people coming here to have children so that those children would be citizens?
Well, there is absolutely nothing that supports that argument that people are coming just to become U.S., to have their children become U.S. citizens. That was actually a winning argument till 1970. When people thought that someone would just cross from Mexico, come here for a day or two, and give birth to a child, and that child, because of being a U.S. citizen, can then sponsor their parents to become green card holders. That was considered a significant pull. Congress changed that law in the 1970s that no one can be sponsored for citizenship unless you're 21. So I don't think there's any substantial evidence that people are coming to have babies in the United States only so that this could lead to their permanent residence.
So Donald Trump in the campaign had said he wants to eliminate birthright citizenship. What does that mean? And if it's in the Constitution, can he do it by himself?
So if he or anyone else wanted to change it, most legal scholars believe that they'll have to change the Constitution. The arguments from some legal scholars is that you could just change it by a statute, that Congress could say that we are interpreting subject to the jurisdiction of the United States to mean that you must be born in the United States to at least one legal parent, if not both legal parents, or both of them have to be citizens and not just permanent residents. That's sort of what's in the debate, is that can Congress do that? Yes, Congress could obviously enact any statute that it wants. It's the opinion of many constitutional scholars. If Congress did that, that would then get appealed, and then the Supreme Court will have to decide whether it meets the strict language of the 14th Amendment.
So if birthright citizenship were to get eliminated like this, how would it affect migration into the United States? Do you think we'd see fewer people trying to cross the border illegally if this isn't a huge problem to begin with?
I think there is really no evidence that that would change, because that was answering your earlier question. Is this why people are coming? I don't think there is any evidence that that's what is driving people to come here. I think what it will do, though, largely in our country, is that large number of people may become permanently undocumented and potentially even stateless. That right now, one of the major advantages of the birthright citizenship is that everyone, at least at birth, is considered equal in terms of their civics rights.
Muzaffar Chishti is a senior fellow with the Migration Policy Institute and the director of the MPI office at New York University, where we reached him. Mr. Chishti, thank you very much for your time today. Thanks for your analysis.
Thanks so much for having me.
That'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform. And online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.